Okay, everybody, welcome to another live edition of Free For All. I'm your host, Big John, and tonight we have a very special guest. I've been getting lucky. I've been catching some of the best and the brightest that both the LP and libertarians in general have to offer. And I have to tell you, my guest tonight is someone that I've had the pleasure of interviewing before, long form, but tonight we get to talk more about his current issues and the good work he's doing out in the community, putting some real practicality, real pragmatism behind his libertarianism. Everyone, please say hello to Spike Cohen. Spike, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, man. And I'm sorry if I was distracted there. I was just sharing the link to the video so people can tune in. But I appreciate you having me on, John. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, man. And always a pleasure to talk to you. And I say this with all sincerity. There's a couple of guys in the Liberty Movement that I just find personally agreeable to my personality, and people that I've had the pleasure of talking to. I count you among those people, someone like a Larry Sharp, even a Mike Tremonti and a Chase Oliver. I just Lars, a lot of the guys in the Liberty Movement today, I find very aligned with my thinking as a libertarian, which I agree is not everybody. I mean, we have some great memes we'll share from you later, but always glad to have you on board. And for those out there watching us, if you're on YouTube, Rumble, or Facebook Live, please feel free, as you're watching this, send in some questions for Spike. We'll be taking those throughout the show. If you're on X, you can watch the show on X, but Elon has made that API to StreamYard very expensive, and we can't see your questions on X. But we are monitoring the feed itself, so if we can get that in directly, we will as well. But if you want to send in your questions directly, YouTube, Rumble, or Facebook Live. All right, so one of the things I wanted to discuss with you, Spike, right away, is your nonprofit organization, You Are the Power. Yeah. You guys do some great work. For those that follow Spike on X, you'll see him put up these notices every so often about families being reunited in the positive sense. But unfortunately, Spike, we also see a lot of this continued, what I consider to be abuse by the state, literally tearing families apart. And tell us a little bit. I know you've been focusing on Georgia recently. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the situation that You Are the Power is trying to tackle in this realm.
Sure. So it comes down to child trafficking by the state. And the way we came across it is You Are the Power. What we do is we find people that are being abused by their local and state governments. And we organize our thousands of members across the country, and we organize the public. We get the message out there. We create viral content to get the public behind understanding what's happening in this case. And then we fight until the public officials back off and do the right thing and leave whoever they're bothering alone. And more often than not, we win. And so we found out about this family, the Hernandez family, and we had heard about a similar case in Dallas, Texas last year. A family in Dallas that had a similar situation, but it seemed there like it was just kind of like a one-off thing that happened. Right. But we found out about the Hernandez family, and basically what happened was the Hernandez parents, their names are Matt and Tucky Hernandez. They have a daughter, Emma, and she was newly born. She was only a couple of months old, a few months old, and she was bruising and having swelling in her legs and was crying. And so they took her to the hospital, and the hospital did some, did some blood work and did a run up. And before they got the results back, the child abuse pediatrician said, "This looks like abuse." Now, the way that should work is that officers show up, do an investigation, decide if there's enough reason to temporarily hold the child until they get the test results to see, what's going on here. Instead, they just seized both kids and they arrested the parents. Even after a caseworker came to their house and reported that the home looked perfectly fine, the children looked very well loved, they still seized the kids, and they charged the parents. And as a condition of bail for them to be able to get a bail bond, to be able to go home and not spend indefinitely in jail, the both parents, the husband and wife, had to agree not to live with, speak with, or come within a certain number of feet of each other until the entire case was adjudicated.
So and, they weren't even offering supervised so this is bad enough to begin with without any proof, but yeah. Just to be clear, they weren't even, as a condition of their bail, for example, they weren't even allowed supervised time with their children, right? The condition of the bail, from what I'm hearing you say, is no contact at all, right?
Initially, not only were they not allowed supervised visitation of their kids, they weren't allowed to be around one another as husband and wife. Wow. They weren't allowed to live together. They weren't allowed to talk to one another.
Wow.
What's the reason to punish them? Oh, we'll get into what the reason is for that.
Okay.
The pain is the point, and we're going to get into that. We then find out that Matt and Tucky then start fighting separately now because they're not even allowed to talk with one another. They're now forced to be estranged from one another. They're both fighting to get the medical records, and they're getting a lot of pushback on getting the medical records. And when they finally do get the medical records, they find out why. Every bit of evidence shows that there is no reason to think that there's abuse, and there's every reason to think that she has one of two possible chronic health disorders, either neonatal rickets or osteogenesis imperfecta, both of which do cause the exact injuries that she's seeing, and that there was no other evidence of anything that would indicate that there was actual abuse that was happening that was causing these fractures and this bruising that they were seeing. It's a connective tissue disorder that's causing it. Mm. And for some reason, not only were they not dropping the charges and saying, okay, well, it looks like this was a big misunderstanding, we're so sorry, here, you know, the charges are dropped, here are your kids back, they were fighting to not give them the records. So then they get the records, they go to court, where the family court judge refuses to hear the medical expert testimony from the medical experts that their attorneys hired, saying that there was no cause of abuse. The only testimony she would allow was of a child abuse pediatrician who hadn't even originally seen Emma, and who said, oh, yeah, well, if you look statistically, these 10 cases like this tend to be abuse. And when he was asked what the source of that statistic was, he said, you can find stuff like that on the internet. That was who the judge allowed to hear the test. That was who the judge allowed to give testimony, not the medical experts who had actually reviewed the case, the medical evidence, and said, there's nothing here. Everything here shows that she has a medical condition. They continued to hold Emma and Aria. The judge had dug in her heels. The caseworkers, everyone involved, dug in their heels. And then we found out about it. And we immediately went to work to vet the cause and make sure that what we were being told was true. We looked at our team looked at literally dozens of pages of emails and medical evidence and everything else. And it all showed that they were 100% in the right and the government was 100% in the wrong. The Division of Family and Children Services, DFACS, was completely in the wrong. The child abuse pediatrician and the police that were investigating and the judge, they were all in the wrong. And we're sitting there going, why did they do this? So we put that out there, and we tell the public that this has happened. The public rallies almost immediately. The judge backs off and allows more of the testimony, allows them to start having more visitation with the kids. The sort of incremental backing off over time, eventually allow them to temporarily be out of foster care and to live with relatives so that they can actually see them on a more often basis and without supervision and things like that, still not living with the family. And while that's happening, excuse me, a bunch of other families started coming to us in Georgia and in other states, and they all had the exact same story. Their kid was sick. They took him to the hospital. Kid was taken from them. They were charged. Many of them were also forced to be estranged from their spouse or their partner. And we saw the same thing over and over again, and that they were being railroaded in court. Police weren't really doing their job. Child abuse pediatrician had a history of calling cases abuse. Had in some cases, some of them had even been kicked out of medical systems in other states because they just called every case abuse. But yet they're being hired in Florida and in Georgia and in Texas. What's going on here? And we see it over and over again. And that's when we found out under Title IV of the Social Security Act, the Federal Social Security Act, the federal government pays these people to call cases abuse. The original reason for that was to that, you know, there were all these child abuse cases and the states just didn't have enough money to fund it. So anytime that the Child Protective Services said that there was abuse, the federal government would help give them money to help, you know, cover the cost of looking into the case and everything else. Gee, I wonder what could go wrong. They're not paying them to do their job. They're paying them to call it abuse. And if the kid, if they call it abuse, they get paid money. If they get put in foster care, they get paid even more money. If they get permanently removed from their parents and they get placed permanently for adoption, they get even more money. And if it turns out that kid has a health issue, then they get even more money. So what happens is when these child abuse pediatricians see these sick kids, they don't think, wow, this is a sick kid. We better get them help. They think, cha-ching, we're going to get the maximum amount of money. It's child trafficking.
So Spike, because what you just said is mind blowing. So I just want to pause for a second and let it sink in. And my questions may almost seem pedantic because I'm stunned now, you know, literally. So I'll just, you know, bear with me, please. So what you have literally described goes beyond, I think, mere politics. So, for example, as you first started relaying the story, I'm like, well, not that I agree with any of this, but I've seen it happen, say, in New York City, where overzealous caseworkers were burned where they allowed an abuse case to go through. So now they're super tight with everything, right? So as you first started the story, I'm like, well, maybe this is that case and it was an error, but at least it was due to an overzealous caseworker. But then as that story went on and on, not only did it become political, like at the point where you said, well, the judge relented only because you are the power, help focus some attention and get some and get some attention to it. Because if he was still convinced that it was abuse, no amount of pressure would have gotten him to change his mind, right? Or her mind.
Exactly.
So now I'm thinking political, but now you're throwing like the forkball at me by saying there's incentive. At every step of the political ladder here, to steal or to break up families by taking their children away from them.
Yep.
This is horrifying, Spike. And when you said this is, when we had talked previously, you said, hey, man, I've got a case of like systemic child trafficking, and it's not the one you see in the movies, right? It's something that's happening under our noses, under the auspices of I assume, is it state governments or the federal government or both?
Well, so it is the state government agencies, whatever each state calls their child protective services. And it's, you know, DCFS in some states, DFCS in South Carolina is called DSS, it's, you know, CPS, there's a bunch of, but they're state's child protective services, but it's partially funded by the federal government. And so what happens is because the federal government's funding it that way, the states end up funding it the same way. And so you're getting state and federal money. And you're right. There is also the CYA aspect of it that, you know, you got a caseworker and here's what they know. If and it starts at the pediatrician, it starts right at the beginning, the CAP, the child abuse pediatrician. And I want to be clear for a second. There is no such thing as child abuse pediatrics. Like that's not a specialty. It's literally a doctor that didn't get taken by any of the private practices when they got out of residency. And so they find out that they can get a job with the state basically working at the children's hospital. And if a case comes in that involves a fracture or bruising or anything that might potentially be abused, they take a look at it, but they're just doctors. And it's literally just a GP, a general practitioner, doctor. And when the caseworker, the CAP, the caseworker supervisor, the family court judge, everyone down the line, if they don't call it abuse and it turns out to be abuse, well, now they have to deal with the guilt of the fact that they didn't stop that abuse. They're now up for performance review, especially since they didn't get any money because they're not getting that additional top up of federal and state funding because they didn't call it abuse. And so, well, why would I do that? Instead, if I call it abuse and I just push it down the food chain, you know, I stamped it abuse here and let the next group of people look at it. I get money, my department or agency gets money. If it turns out not to be abuse, okay, great. They get their kids back, but I don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. I just did my job. I called it abuse and I got my piece of it. The problem is everyone's doing that down the entire food chain. The child abuse pediatrician, the investigating and arresting officers, the caseworker, the caseworker's supervisor, the family court judge, the people overseeing the foster care system, the foster parents, they call them visitation thrive centers or visitation centers, the vendors that run these places that people go to do visitations of their kids that are in foster care, the entire network of adoption program, all of that gets funded through this. And so there is every incentive in place to call it abuse, whether it is or not, and right. every disincentive in place to not call it abuse, even if it obviously isn't. And so they're literally paying them to look the other way and ignore the evidence that there's no evidence of abuse.
And that also
leaves children more vulnerable to actual abusers because right. those cases require investigation, right? Like someone who's actually abusing their kids is probably going to try to cover their tracks. And if the police show up, they're going to be evasive. But if you haven't done anything wrong and you don't understand how the justice system works, the cops show up and they want to talk, you tell them everything. You don't have anything to hide. I didn't do anything wrong. I just want my kid back. This is a huge misunderstanding. My kid was not feeling well. I understand you guys are trying to protect us, but we did nothing wrong here. Come into my home. I'll answer any question you have. Wait, why are you arresting me? It is a system of child trafficking that is incentivized through funding at the state and federal level.
And what's even more concerning is for these children who do suffer from some rare malady, whether it's the rickets or some sort of anemia that may manifest as bruising or brittle bone disease or something to that effect. Then they're going untreated because everywhere along the line, there's these bureaucrats telling you it was abuse. And yet the child is still suffering because they still have the underlying disease. What's interesting to me here, though, Spike, especially in the Hernandez case, is the refusal of the judge to accept any other medical testimony other than the one of the state abuse pediatrician, even though we know there's no such thing, but the state doctor, right? Like, what do you think drove that? Because one would hope the judge is not incentivized in any way, right?
No, the judge is incentivized. The family court system is incentivized to be a part of this. And the answer is very simple. The reason that she didn't allow the testimony is because the entire case would immediately fall apart. If every bit of evidence shows that Emma Hernandez has some kind of chronic health condition that explains this abuse, and there's zero evidence of actual abuse, case dismissed. There's nothing there. There's no reason. And then they can inform the criminal prosecutors that there's no case to be had. And that's the end of that. And so they're literally incentivizing this. And so now some good news with the Hernandez family. The most recent update is that DFACS has dropped the case. For some reason, the family court judge and DFACS, after having thousands of people angrily emailing them and text messaging them and calling them and mentioning them on social media over the past several months, ever since we found out about this, for some reason, they made a complete 180 and have decided to allow the Hernandez kids to live with family full time and be out of the foster care system.
Yeah. Now, and I'm sorry, Spike. I just wanted to pull this up while you're talking, just to put some humanity to the story that you're describing. These are the two Hernandez kids that you are the power. Your organization tweeted this out. We are one step closer now to getting the Hernandez kids reunited with Matt and Tucky for good. Thank you to everyone who has tirelessly supported this family from the beginning. You are so appreciated. And look at these two angels in this picture.
And the youngest one is Emma, the one that they've been denying. She's finally getting care for her illness.
Man, thank God.
The older one, Aria, Emma's a baby, hasn't even fully been aware of what's going on. Aria has been completely aware the whole time. Every time Aria sees her parents for visitation, she says, "Why can't I go home?" And they're not allowed to tell her. and they and they say she, you know, they have to make up things. They have to say, "Oh, we're working on the house," or, you know, we're going to get you back as soon as possible. She's a little girl for like what, a third, a quarter of her life. She's been experiencing this, and she's saying, "Why can't I go home?" She used to love dancing, and she used to love playing, and she had all these hobbies and interests. And over these last few months, she's become more and more withdrawn because she doesn't understand. Do my parents not want me? Why am I living with these strangers? Thankfully, now she's back with actual family, at least, right? So that has been very helpful. But like, they've watched the light go out of their toddler's eyes because they're not, she's not allowed. And she wasn't even, there was never any question whether or not she was being abused, but she was taken too. And the point of that, here's why they do this, John. You said, why would they do this? Why would they not only take your kids, but also like not allow you to be with your wife? They want you to suffer because the whole time what they're telling you is, listen, if you just say you did it, you're not going to have your kids back, but this whole thing will be over. You'll get to be with your wife again. If you plead down to something, we probably won't even put you in jail. You'll have something on your record, but you'll be able to get it past you. Your kids aren't coming back, but we might allow you to have, remote supervised visits with them on holidays or something. And, you know, you're young, you can have more kids. This is what people have been told.
That's the way you turn gangsters against each other.
Yeah, it's literally like they're literally torturing these people, turning the screws to them and saying, listen, if you just sign off on it, you can get back to as normal a life as possible and we'll be on our way. It's like the most horrific type of mob activity you could consider. The mob would never do this, right? Like when you think about this type of thing, and yet these people are doing it. And they're like sitting by the office cooler drinking coffee to try to stay awake. Like it's just some humdrum job because this is how they're paid. It's a horrific system.
And Spike, I'm sure there must be some qualified immunity involved here where.
Oh, absolutely.
The Hernandezes cannot have any sort of redress in any court, right?
Well, not in civil court. These caseworkers, if it ever comes to it, the caseworkers will absolutely claim qualified immunity. The police officers will absolutely claim qualified immunity. The judge, because she's an actual judge, can claim absolute immunity because judges and prosecutors and politicians get absolute immunity. Of course, the state gets sovereign immunity. So it's like literally, if anything happens, what will happen is that they'll sue the state and the taxpayers, the rest of us, will pay for some kind of settlement. And part of me says, hey, you know what? These parents went through so much. They get a settlement. That's great. It's so terrible that they even had to go through it. But the other part of me saying, why should the taxpayers have to pay for this? They're taxpayers too. They're helping pay for their own settlement. No, there's absolutely immunity works its way into this. So what we're at, in addition to helping these families on a case-by-case basis like we're doing now and getting the public to understand just how widespread of an issue that this is, we're also working with legislators and advocates and attorneys to craft model legislation that fixes this at its core by changing the incentive structure so that they're not getting paid to call it abuse. They're getting paid to do their job, whether it's abuse or not. It becomes a outcome neutral funding system, but also to do something undo something that never should have happened back when it happened in the 70s. I believe the 70s was when it started. Child abuse needs to be treated like any other criminal act. There needs to be a criminal charge. That part of the case should not be handled in family court. The decision of whether or not abuse is present and the children should be taken or not should be decided in criminal court, or at the very least with a criminal court level of due process and standard of evidence. Because what's happening is these family courts are operating like administrative tribunals who go, yeah, it looks to me like this is abuse. All right, take their kids. And there's no, the appeals aren't the same. The level of evidence required isn't the same. My understanding is you can't request a jury trial or anything like that. All of that needs to go back into the criminal court system where there's at least some semblance of due process and standard of evidence to be applied here. Those two things, it's not going to make it perfect by any stretch, but those two things. Oh, and if there is an exigent circumstance where the police determine, okay, listen, this could be abuse. These kids could be in immediate danger and they have to seize the kids. There has to be some kind of time limit where they have to either prove that there's abuse or give the kids back, whether it's 48 hours or 5 days or 3 days or whatever it is. You can't just indefinitely take the kids and go, oh, you know, this was an exigent thing. That's why we've held them for the last year and a half or 6 months or whatever. That's nonsense. If you don't have enough evidence at that point to go forward with the trial, you got to get the kids back. And so those three things would make a major move towards fixing this at its core so that the thousands of families that are going through this won't have to go through it anymore.
That's great, Spike. And we have something from one of our viewers. Linda in YouTube says, how can I support your truth to power, Spike?
Well, thank you, Linda. If you want to join You Are the Power, if you go to youarethepower.net, Y-O-U-A-R-E, thepower.net, then you can sign up. Oh, there it is right there. You can sign up today and become a member. If you're able to make a donation, you can either just make a one-time donation or you can become a paid member. Members are members, whether you're a free member or a paid member. The paid memberships only come with, you know, some additional merch and swag and stuff that comes with it and the knowledge that you're helping to fund the work that we're doing. But whether you pay or not, we want you as a member. We want you to be a part of this movement. We want you to get regular notifications about the causes that we're working on so that you can help spread the word. We want you to download the app, which you'll be able to do once you're a member, so that you can get push notifications to your phone when the newest causes come out, so that you can be right on top of all of this. We want you to be a part of it. So if you go to youarethepower.net, you can sign up today, you can donate, you can do whatever it is that you can are in a position to do to help us grow this movement, help people now and spread the liberty movement in doing so.
Yeah, that's great. I want to emphasize, and I, by the way, Spike, I still think you ought to reach out. You have your people reach out to the Interrupters, punk ska band. They have a song called Take Back the Power. I think it's perfect for your organization.
To let
the people, I'll send you the link. I'll send Brian the link. I think it's such a natural connection, and they are a libertarian band, so hopefully they'll be willing to let you use their song. But not to get overly political here, but I have to ask. I hear this story. Thankfully, there was a You Are the Power. There was a Spike Cohen around to say, hey, let's get involved on the part of the Hernandez family and other families like them. You mentioned Georgia as particularly being perhaps where something like this may happen more frequently.
They're one of the worst. They lost 2,000 children. They lost, since COVID, they have lost roughly 2,000 minors, some of who just graduated out of the system. They turned 17. They have no idea where they are.
Oh, when you say lost, you mean literally.
They don't know where they are.
They've lost
children of all different ages. They just have no idea. They have no clue where they are. They could be in another country, God knows, doing what. They have no idea. Or they might still be in the same home. They literally have no idea where they are. They completely lost them. As far as we can tell, they aren't really making a serious effort to even find them.
Yeah. Adam Cahoon says, my God. Yeah, Adam, absolutely. Yeah. My God. That should be everyone's reaction to this. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, Spike, when I hear something like this, it totally reinforces my libertarian thinking. Now, let me say up front, in no way am I an anarchist, okay? I'm a minarchist. I admit my fault to you like that, okay? And I know you and I are not aligned 100%. From the last time we talked, I think you and I are probably hand-in-hand 90-95% of the time. It's just that little bit, right? Yeah. But in this particular case, I tend to side with you because in these situations, my first instinct is always you have to really work to show me that parents are working in against the best interests of their children. It's just my experience. I have a child with special needs. The thought of me or my wife ever doing anything either knowingly or unknowingly against his best interests is, I can't even conceive of something like that. Do I agree that there's individuals out there who unfortunately are just not looking out for their kids? Yes. But the default position should always be, let's listen to the parents, in my opinion, whether it comes to vaccination, taking care of them, looking after them, taking them to the hospital.
Yeah.
How do you tie this in with recent calls for the government to step in and be the to quote stop child abuse when it comes to things like puberty blockers? And that seems to be the hot thing, right? The gender thing.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Without taking a position, because I'm not going to ask you that, it doesn't really matter for the purposes of this question. Let's leave aside the validity of transitioning puberty blockers, gender affirmation, confirmation, whatever. Leave that aside for the moment. But the very concept that libertarians are calling for the state to become the de facto decider of whether a therapy for minors is permissible or not ahead of the parents. Talk to me a little bit about that, because help me understand. I find that, see, to me, the default libertarian position is you start with the parents who are looking out in the best interest of their minor children. Yeah. I agree that there are real cases of abuse. And even if you and I both hate the state, if they have a function, this might be considered one of them, right?
Protecting children, right.
Protecting children. Talk to me about what you're hearing in general about this movement to, hey, we got to make gender care for minors, puberty hormones. We got to make those illegal. Let's label it child abuse from the get-go. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, so this is a complex one because, yes, I don't trust the state to be making that decision. The problem is that's not where it started. Where it started was in the schools, which are almost always run by the government, where they're pushing this stuff. And then it's also in the regulatory boards that are pushing this stuff and the licensing offices that are threatening doctors who don't do this stuff with removing their licensing. So the government intervention was already happening. And so this what we're increasingly finding, the more we find out about this, we're finding two things, and I will take my position on this. We're finding the more evidence we have, the more that we're finding that the idea of using any kind of a permanent body altering treatment, including these puberty blockers, they are not reversible. The hormone levels might return to normal once you stop using them, but how they affected your body over the course of that time that you didn't have puberty or that you had more testosterone, if it's a girl being transitioned to a boy or whatever, like those things are irreversible or very often permanent and irreversible, as much or in some cases the exact same as a surgery would be. Or at a similar level. It's literally changing how your body's developing. They might as well do a surgery in some cases. We're finding out that using that kind of treatment, when the fact is that just about every study I've seen shows that anywhere from like 85 to 90% of kids who present with gender dysphoria end up what they call desisting. They just stop at some point, usually around puberty. It's like they feel awkward and then those hormones kick in. Now they're not awkward anymore. Now they're awkward in a different way. They're another, horny teenager or whatever, but like they're no longer questioning what they are. And, or maybe it's when they reach, early adulthood or when they start to really like start developing their identity coming into their late adolescence, into their, mid to late teens. When it's that high of a number that end up just not being not having gender dysphoria anymore, the idea of giving them any kind of thing that could potentially change that to me just seems like malpractice. So right off the bat, that seems pretty obvious to me. And especially in light of now that most of these studies came out before these things were like popularly discussed on Reddit and TikTok and stuff like that. So now you've got this possible like kids trying to find their identity and saying, well, maybe I'm also non-binary or trans or something like that. There's just you couple that with, parents that have cluster B disorders like Munchausen by proxy or histrionic personality disorder. Like there's just so many things that can go wrong here. So I will say I personally like this looks like a disaster waiting to happen or a disaster that is unfolding. And I think a lot of these kids, we're already seeing that a lot of them are starting to realize that like they were taken down a path when someone should have been saying, hey, listen, let's give this some time, figure out what it is that you think about this. We're not judging you one way or another. If you feel this way, that's fine. We're not going to tell you who and what you are, but we're not going to make any kind of permanent change. We're going to let you kind of figure this out as you go along. And then if once they're an adult, they decide this, then they can do whatever they want. It's their body at that point. They're an adult. They can make that decision. I do not believe that government's the best way to handle this. And so rather than try to focus on further weaponizing child protective services by giving them yet another thing to take kids over, right? I instead say we need to be first, before we do anything like that, we need to be looking at where the government has been actually pushing these types of things. You know, we've seen too much where the government is working directly with big pharma to push for things that may not be as safe as effective as they tell us, and right. are often trying to either mandate it or heavily pressure us and coerce us into doing so. I think right off the bat, I think we can all agree the government shouldn't have their thumb on the scale there. They should be letting science and doctors determine what's best for their patients, not trying to pressure them to go one way or another on that. Outside of that, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, no, CPS should not be abusing, should not be, for example, we all agree child abuse is bad, but they shouldn't be taking kids from innocent parents who didn't abuse them, right? So in the same token, if this is abuse, and if there is a role for the state, if the state exists, right, like, if we don't live in minarchy or anarchy, we live in a government that assumes authority over these types of things. If we have the government that's supposed to be doing it, their role is to protect people, including children. And then this would be one of the things that they would be protecting against. But we need to be making very, very clear that that there needs to be a heavy level of due process. So long before I would be advocating for them to have more power, I would be pushing for the kind of model legislation we're pushing for to make sure that any kind of accusations of mistreatment by parents or abuse or neglect by parents has a high standard of evidence and a high level of due process where they can't just be seizing kids and trafficking them left and right. But it is not as clear cut as I wish it was, because again, it's you have competing ideological elements within government. One side's trying to say, no, we're going to force doctors to do this stuff. And then you got another side saying, no, we're going to force them not to do it. And whether you think this one's corrective or you think this one's corrective, the reality is you have government basically pulling both sides of the scale. All of that, that all needs to stop. And then we need to, if there is going to be a role of government to say, okay, we're going to protect kids from out of control parents who decide that, instead of getting a designer dog, they're going to have a trans kid, if there is a role for them to protect kids from what is objectively does look like medical abuse, there needs to be a very high standard, threshold, a high standard of evidence and a lot of due process there, so that we don't just have CPS having yet another reason to traffic children like they're doing right now.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that's probably somewhere where I would say, again, in YouTube, Life of Agony says, just despicable. I'm not sure if Life is referring to the original Hernandez conversation or even what we're talking about here. Yeah. But in both cases, yes, it is despicable. And so I agree with you, because I find it funny that, on the one hand, we could say we've got a government that's so despicable as to incentivize the breakup of families. And it's not. Yeah. Theoretical here, right? It's not some slippery slope argument.
They're doing it
right now.
They're literally doing it. Yeah.
Do we want them to have the power to say, in your kid's case, which again, I think always comes down to the medical aspect of it, your kid can or cannot take these hormones. Your kid is required to take the MMR vaccine, right? Because just as easily, some government bureaucrat can say, a kid who doesn't get the MMR vaccine. That constitutes abuse, right? I could see that very, and I mean, we kind of have it now, right? So that to me is always going to be that bright line but the model that you outlined, like, okay, let's say I'm a parent, I don't want to vaccinate my kid for whatever reason, let me go to court. Rather than have the default position, the government saying, no, you must vaccinate your kid, the default position should be, come prove to me one way or another what you want to do for your kid isn't abuse.
Or actually, actually, we have to prove that.
Oh, the government, right?
And,
the government,
and there has to be a. And I get what you're saying. Yeah. We have to, because what we're supposed to have is innocent until proven guilty. What we currently have is guilty, and you're not even allowed to try to prove you're innocent. Like, we won't hear your testimony. We won't, or your medical expert testimony. We won't look at your evidence. We'll just decide that you're guilty. You're guilty, and we're going to wait to then tell you you're guilty in a few months when your trial comes up, and that's going to be the end of that. So we definitely, you know, that's why, and I've told people this, I've said, listen, you know, I absolutely believe that for the vast majority of these cases, at the very least, the idea of giving these irreversible treatments to these kids, the vast majority of whom are not even going to, you know, think about gender dysphoria in a few more years, is a terrible, terrible way of doing this. And we should absolutely be looking at where government has been either incentivizing, coercing, or outright forcing doctors and providers to be doing this stuff. Before we start getting the government involved in enforcing on the other end of saying, no, we're not going to let you do this, you're not going to have my support on that until there's a lot of more due process in place than there is right now. Because I'm watching every day how, again, no one watching this thinks it's okay to hit a kid or to break a kid's leg, right? Like, everyone says that's wrong.
Right.
But I am watching how that protecting kids against abuse, like outright undebated abuse, is being used to take innocent kids or sick kids, kids with chronic illnesses, from innocent parents. And so long before you're going to get me on board with giving them even more enforcement ability, they need to have they need to remove any kind of payment structure that's based on outcomes. It needs to be based on work they did, not whether or not it was considered abuse. It needs to just be, we're not telling you that, we're not paying you to decide either way. We're paying you just to do your job and work through these cases, however many cases you have. B, removing the perverse incentive structure that's in place, that's A, and B, reintroducing the due process, so that, you know, like, there actually has to be a high standard of evidence, whether that means bringing it back into the criminal court system or just requiring the family courts to use that same standard of evidence that they would in a criminal court case. Once you do that, then I'm on board with if the state's job, if we're saying the state's job is to protect kids and that this is abuse, I'm on board with them having that ability. But they got to show first that they're not just using this as the newest reason to traffic even more kids.
Yeah. And like you said, if you tug on that thread a little bit more, it unwinds all the way back to the position of government doing social engineering.
Yes.
Through the public schools. And yes, I agree with it. So you and I are perfectly aligned on this part, at least.
Yeah.
Get rid of the state education, get rid of the state schools, get rid of all of that. That addresses a lot of these issues. To the greatest extent possible, you leave those decisions for minors up to their parents. I mean, you're going to find exceptions where there's no parents or there's runaways or there's orphans or something, right? But I'm saying, like, the vast majority of the cases should be covered by the parents. Just checking out some comments here. Linda says, Glenn Beck was exposing this type of thing in Boston years ago, a hospital forcefully taking a child.
Yeah,
have you two ever talked? Uniting against this sounds like a good idea. So I'm assuming Linda's saying, have you ever talked with Glenn Beck about possibly teaming up with him or teaming up with the conservatives on this particular issue to try to avoid these issues with kids being families being torn apart over some perverse incentives?
Yeah, so I haven't talked directly with Glenn. I've done some writing and op-eds and stuff before for The Blaze, but I've never talked directly with Glenn. Short answer is I would love to. I would love to sit down with Glenn and anyone else on The Blaze to talk about how this medical kidnapping thing, you know, it's been a touchy subject because as soon as people hear Children Protective Services, medical kidnapping, we kind of, I mean, I'll tell you, when I first heard these cases, my initial default was, are we sure that this is what we're being told? Are we sure, like, this, you know, maybe there's some context missing. Maybe they were being kind of neglectful. Maybe they, you know, they weren't quite as good as parents. Maybe the government went too far, but, you know, they're literally just taking, you know, kids from parents that have done absolutely nothing wrong. I saw the evidence for myself. And then now to see it, it's now I realize it's a widespread thing.
Well, it's a pattern now.
It's a pattern. And you realize why. Because it there's this disbelief of like, but they wouldn't do this. But then you realize they're getting paid to do it. And I mean, I've talked to people who have been fighting this fight for 20, 25 years. And they're so thrilled we're involved because they said, we're finally seeing some movement. And I said, it's because we're not tied directly to just this. We just look for abuse by government and then we fight against it. And once we found this, we're like, this is as abusive of a government as we can think of. Stealing your kids and you did nothing wrong. That's as abusive and horrific as it gets. There are people that would say, you know what? Execute me. Take my home. Put me in jail for 10 years. Don't take my children from my wife. Don't tell me that I can't ever talk to my wife again. I'd rather go to jail for 5 years or 10 years and know that my kids are safe at home with my wife. And when I get out, I can go back to them. This is the worst punishment you could do for a parent.
It's just like you said, this is so unbelievable that when I started seeing you and You Are the Power tweet out this stuff, I was like, my initial reaction was, okay, maybe it's some CYA bureaucrat. Like I told you, really thought that was my default way. It was my mind trying to make sense of what seems to be literally an evil sort of situation. And I'm like, okay, there's gotta be, I refuse to believe people are this evil on a large scale. But like to hear you, it's just, it's mind boggling to me. And folks,
that was my assumption too. When I first heard it, I'm like, this is just out of control bureaucrats or, you know, really ignorant doctors. And then the more we heard about it, it's like, oh, they're getting, as soon as I heard about the Title IV of Social Security Act, it clicked for all of us. We're like, oh, they're getting paid to do this. And you realize like it's for the most base reason of all, it's to make money. It destroys a family in the process. Oh, well, you know, got to break some eggs. It's horrific.
That's insanity. And again, to everybody out there, please go check out youarethepower.net. If you're a libertarian, if you're just a decent human being and you want to see abusive government held accountable and more importantly, to curb these abusive activities, please go to youarethepower.net. Spike and his team, they're doing fantastic work. They're doing the Lord's work. You should really go check them out. Consider making a donation. Help out youarethepower.net. Okay, Spike, let me also remind before I get to my next part of the show, Spike, let me remind everyone, if you're out there listening, you want to ask Spike a question, head on over to YouTube, Rumble, Facebook Live. Just look for Grumblings Media on all three of those platforms. If you watch the show there, you can use their comment system. We'll see it directly in the studio. You could ask Spike your questions. He's agreed. He'll answer everyone's questions to the greatest extent he can. So go there. If you're on X, I apologize. It's just that there's no API, like the crawl says. Elon hasn't built the right type of API for our studio. So complain to Elon if you're on X, because I know we do have a large audience on X. Okay. Spike, I saw a meme. Let me pop it up here. I loved it. It's a meme from you, and it says, organizing libertarians is like hurting butterflies that are on meth.
Yeah.
And you're also on meth.
Correct.
Everyone is on meth. Yeah. This to me was, I had to LOL on that one, Spike. And to that point, let me just ask you about libertarianism and Libertarian Party, because the two are not necessarily the same thing, as we know.
Right.
And let's just talk a little bit, because there's a lot of things going on. I want to throw out some of the things that I'm seeing. Now, the Libertarian National Convention, there was a lot of controversy. I mean, as far as controversy amongst libertarians being above the normal drama, right? And it had to do with the invitation of non-libertarians as guest speakers to address libertarians at the convention. Donald Trump, RFK Jr., Vivek Ramaswamy, Thomas Massie, although Massie seemed to me to be a natural fit, of course. even though he's a
Republican. And that was literally, he was just doing like a little victory lap through our right. through our convention after he submitted the end the Fenn bill. If anyone had a problem with that, he wasn't even there really hawking anything. He was literally just there to be like, yeah, I just introduced end the Fenn. We're all like, yay, end the Fenn. Like that to me was harmless. I didn't even see any controversy there.
And obviously Ron Paul coming to speak, that was a natural fit as well, right? So and Mass, even though he's a Republican, I kind of view him like a Amash. They may have run as Republicans just like Ron Paul did, but at heart, I think most of us libertarians would consider they're libertarians. Right.
Yeah.
Now, you had, I thought, to my mind, you had a great speech at the convention. You had 15 minutes. I loved your speech because it was basically saying out loud what I had been writing, what I had been tweeting about, what I had been doing shows on, and my concerns with some of the things going on. So let me just play the first clip I have of your...
If we run a candidate for president who is openly hostile to libertarianism, we might qualify for the debates. And millions of Americans, and not to mention many other millions around the world, will get exposed to libertarianism for the first time from someone who's openly hostile to libertarianism. Oh, but hear me out. Not only that, we might even get 5%, giving us major party status and ensuring that in every single election cycle, we will be pressured to run another anti-liberty candidate to maintain our status, brilliant, thereby becoming an active detriment to the liberty movement.
Brilliant.
And all we have to do to get this incredible deal is demonstrate to the American voter and to ourselves that we are worse than what we seek to replace. Let's be very clear about something. Republicans and Democrats usually hold out to actually win before they sell out. If we are willing to sell out our principles and run someone who is hostile to our ideas for the possible...
Okay, so that little excerpt there spoke to me a lot because I heard a lot leading up, you know, there's the usual libertarians, you know, trying to herd those meth addicted butterflies that you referenced in the meme. Like we all, you know, the old joke, if you have, you know, four libertarians in a room, you have four different opinions of that. The other three are not real libertarians, right? That seems par for the course, right?
Yeah.
But when you look beyond that, this was a real sticking point. There were some that said, hey, any publicity is good publicity. And when the RFK caravan comes to town, when the Donald Trump caravan comes to town, that's good. People are watching libertarians. My point from the beginning was, no, they're watching Donald Trump's idea of libertarianism. They're watching RFK's idea of libertarianism. So if your goal was to spread libertarianism, are you doing that with these guys? Or are you just giving them more? And honestly, I'll be up front. I thought the Donald Trump libertarian swag was a bridge too far. You know what I mean? That they were selling
the
on the website.
They were selling. Yeah, that was a bit much.
So when you did that speech, just to finish it off, literally, I wasn't at the convention. I was watching it live stream, and out loud, you could hear me just saying, "Brilliant, brilliant." Love Spike for what he just said. How was the reaction of the crowd when you said that? It seemed to me to be a little lukewarm. How did you sense it when you were up at the podium?
So because of how the AV, the audio was set up, you couldn't really hear from the audience. The audience was been basically universal agreement. And keep in mind, that was a speech that I originally was supposed to give at the beginning, at the open of business that day, before they started voting. But different things kept happening that pushed it further and further back. So by the time I was actually giving the speech, it was like the fourth round of voting or the fifth round of voting. So RFK had already been knocked out in the first round. So I wasn't, originally I was there to try to tell people, here's why the idea of nominating RFK is dead on arrival. And there wasn't really much appetite to nominate Trump like that. There were like, I think three people that wrote his name in or something like that. But there were maybe about 15 or so libertarians who wanted to nominate RFK. And so I wanted to make a point of, you know, why he had already been knocked out. But at that point, I wanted to make a point why we should never revisit this idea of running these lukewarm or anti-libertarian candidates. It eliminates the entire purpose of the party. If all we care about, if our primary concern is getting 5% of the vote or getting on the debates, let's just be Republicans and Democrats. They win. They win the elections. They get on the debate stage all the time. And yeah, they don't represent our principles either, but at least we don't have to pretend they do. And, right. and if we join the GOP, we could maybe try to pull it in a more libertarian direction. But if we go to the Libertarian Party and we're pulling it in an authoritarian direction to try to get 5% of the vote, what kind of trade-off is that? We're actually becoming a detriment to the greater brand of libertarianism. Because yes, you're correct. The Libertarian Party is not in and of itself libertarianism. But to most people, if they hear libertarian, if they think anything, they think, yeah, oh yeah, the Libertarian Party. And if the Libertarian Party has become the party of RFK Jr., who, let's be very clear, is openly hostile to ideas like decentralization of power and